Runaway Country is brought to you by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. America has always been more of an argument than a destination, an ongoing debate about power, freedom, belonging, and who gets to define the country itself. As we approach America's 250th anniversary, it is worth remembering that the United States began as a rebellion against monarchy and divine rule. The founders attempted something radical for its time, a secular constitution with no religious tests and a government accountable to the people. That framework created space for freedom of conscience to grow over time, imperfectly, unevenly, but meaningfully. And now, many of those very same questions are resurfacing. We're seeing increasing pressure around the boundaries between religion, government, and public life, debates that affect schools, rights, representation, and who feels fully included in the American story. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is working to protect the First Amendment because it protects everyone's freedom of conscience. Visit ffrf.us/Alex or text my first name, A-L-E-X, to 511-511 to learn more and join. As America 250 approaches, this isn't just about commemorating the past. Go to ffrf.us/Alex. Or text my name, Alex, to 511-511. Remember, Alex to 511-511 today. Message and data rates may apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, everyone. There is an emerging truism in these Trump years. How do you make a bad situation even worse? Throw J.D. Vance in the mix. This week, as President Trump tries to spin his apparent surrender to Iran and capitulation to economic reality as the beginning of a deal to end the war, the administration is sending its most reliably smug and utterly shameless representative to do the hard work of pretending that this is all a good thing. In theory, the vice president is making the rounds to promote a new book about his relationship with Catholicism. We'll have more on that in a second. But in practice, it's been a lot of defense on a supremely vague agreement that the president himself described thusly.
It's a very strong deal. Nobody knows what it is, but it's very strong. And most people seem to be very happy.
Okay. Here's JD on CNN with Jake Tapper this week explaining how and why the Iran deal is a positive.
If you think of like the last 47 years of American relations with Iran, we have never had this level of direct or indirect coordination. We've never had this level of direct communication between the highest levels of their society and the highest levels of our political leadership. So something has fundamentally transformed. Can I say with 100% certainty that they're going to meet every obligation of this bargain? No, of course not.
No, of course not. To some degree, defending a page and a half memorandum that may, in the end, put $300 billion in Iran's pocket, give Iran control of the Strait of Hormuz, and possibly allow Iran to charge fees on every ship that crosses the waterway, for what? It's not clear. To be fair, selling that is an uphill climb for just about anybody. But it is a particularly steep challenge for J.D. Vance, who has a remarkable track record of screwing up almost everything. Remember Hungary?
Viktor Orban has been the single most profound leader in Europe on the question of energy security and independence. I've seen a guy who has ferociously advocated for the interests of Hungary. I'm here to help him in this campaign cycle.
That's the vice president endorsing Hungary's authoritarian prime minister, Viktor Orban, at a campaign event back in April. 1 week later, Orban was voted out in a landslide. Then there's JD's relationship with the Catholic Church. Remember that Pope Francis died just hours after meeting the vice president last year, and the vice president followed that up by insulting the deceased pope in his new book. Meanwhile, Vance is in a very public feud with the current living head of the church, Pope Leo, who Vance condescended to in truly remarkable fashion this April.
I think it's very, very important for the Pope to be careful when he talks about matters of theology.
It's almost as if J.D. Vance has no aptitude for this sort of thing, as if his profound lack of humility and shocking lack of charm and non-existent sense of humor aren't serving him well. If you need more examples of that, here he is at the Munich Security Conference in February of 2025, making what I guess is supposed to be a joke. Spoiler, nobody laughed.
Thank you, Mr. President, very much for your leadership, but also for the kind words about me personally. I knew exactly what I wanted to say, but then after the president said that I was so smart and that I didn't want to repeat our congresswoman who froze for 20 seconds over in Munich, now I'm tempted, sir, just to freeze for 20 seconds and just stare at the cameras, and maybe they'll say nice things about me like they do about Congresswoman Cortez.
On matters both big and small, Vice President J.D. Vance has proven to be profoundly out of touch. And maybe all of this would be funny if he weren't, you know, the Vice President of the United States, with ambitions to be the actual president come 2028. And while J.D. Vance has said a lot of very questionable things in front of cameras and at podiums and in his book, it may be what Vance is doing off camera that is the most damaging. J.D. Vance is not only a bad messenger, he is a bad actor. And the way he's wielding the power of the federal government isn't painfully awkward. It's just painful. I'm Alex Wagner, and this week on Runaway Country, the other war that J.D. Vance has been fighting, the war on blue states. Under the guise of fighting fraud, what exactly has the vice president been up to? Well, if Stephen Miller is a fan of it, then you know it can't be anything good.
Because of the vice president's leadership, you are seeing the most muscular, robust, aggressive, dedicated, determined, and speedy effort to shut down criminal fraud that has not only ever occurred in the history of this country, but in any developed nation.
We are going to get into the vice president's public messaging on what may be the dumbest war in American history, as well as his less public actions in the Trump administration's battle against blue state America, with Majority Report host Sam Cedar. But first, what happens when the vice president and his second generation Doge dogs set their sights on your home turf? J.D. Vance has been helming the administration's anti-fraud task force, which has conveniently found lots of alleged fraud in lots of conveniently blue states. But according to new reporting this week, it may really just be sweeping up legitimate businesses with the goal of scoring political points. I'm talking to California's Attorney General Rob Bonta about what he thinks of the vice president's fraud crackdown, the administration's very specific interests in California and its leaders, and what this all means for 2028. Here's our conversation. Mr. Attorney General, where do we even begin? So there's a lot of interest this week in the vice president, who's out there selling both a book and an apparent deal to end the Iran war. But less discussed is what he is doing on a very real level to blue states in this country. There was a piece in the Washington Post that actually caught our eye, which is where I want to begin, reporting that the vice president's fraud task force, which is something he, I think, is shepherding through with Mehmet Oz, Dr. Oz, the fraud task force has started targeting legitimate businesses in your state. And they focus on a particular business in Los Angeles that's accredited and has zero complaints. It's a hospice. And the fraud task force effectively sort of shuts down this business. Can you talk to me a little bit about what is happening in California and what you've seen unfolding as the vice president focuses on fraud in your state?
Well, what's happening in California and what should be happening is appropriate, precise, committed, comprehensive, thorough enforcement of the law and rooting out of fraud. And that's what my team does. We've done it for years. We've done it for decades. We have some of the top outcomes when it comes to indictments and convictions and recoveries. We're top 10 across the country. It's hard work. It's detailed work. You have to be precise. You have to honor due process. You have to target the fraud specifically and not sweep in businesses that are acting appropriately and lawfully. And when you're focused on the work, your head is down, your sleeves are rolled up, that's what it should look like. Now, here's what shouldn't happen. And this is exactly what the vice president and his fraud unit and Dr. Oz are doing, which is they're politicizing fraud. They're using it as a cudgel, as a weapon to attack their enemies. They're going after blue states in a completely inappropriate partisan way to suggest or even explicitly state that the states, the state leaders, the governors, the elected officials are in on the fraud or part of the fraud, and it's completely outrageous. And they are late to the party. They're welcome to the party to enforce fraud if they're going to do it right, but not if they're going to politicize it like they are. So we're interested in tackling fraud here in California. They're interested in politicizing fraud. And so what they're doing is they're sort of flipping the script. They're saying you are guilty until you prove you're innocent, completely inappropriate. And they're saying, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. And they're catching in the crossfire and making collateral damage, good faith, law-abiding businesses that are providing a critical service. Let's talk about what hospice is. It's end-of-life care that's dignified and gives dignity in the last years of life for someone to have independence and be at home and be surrounded by loved ones. And they're stopping those legal non-fraudulent businesses from practicing and providing care in their unquenchable thirst to go, to own the Dems and get the libs, and it's completely inappropriate.
I mean, to be clear, your office has been, in fact, focused on fighting fraud, and specifically in the hospice industry. But I mean, you know, you started this conversation by giving a sense that it takes a long time to actually find the businesses that are truly committing fraud, and that if there have been any gains made in fighting fraud, it's the result of some real longstanding efforts to do so. But it sounds like the vice president is sort of sweeping in and trying to take credit for the fraud investigations that predate even this second Trump administration, but also getting so aggressive as to vacuum up businesses that are operating legitimately. Can you give me a sense of the number of businesses that appear to be legitimate that have been swept up in all of this?
It's hard to tell about what we're hearing from businesses, and what you see in the important investigative journalism is that, you know, some of these businesses, you know, it's tens, it's hundreds potentially. They're reaching out to CMS to say, turn our funding back on. We're legitimate. We're not the bad guys. We're providing care. And they're getting told to pound sand, or they're not getting a response. It's too slow. Some of them have to, you know, as the article set forth, they have to shut their doors. When they're providing appropriate care, lawful care, non-fraudulent care. And so, you know, one is too many. You should not be turning off the funding for legitimate businesses. That should be a no-brainer to be able to do that. And so, you know, we've been doing this important work. You have to do it right. We recently, and by the way, every state has what's called an MFUCU, a Medicaid Fraud Control Unit.
Right.
And ours is the Division of Medicaid Fraud and Elder Abuse. And ours is one of the highest performing in the entire nation. We deliver time and time again. Of course, they're also, you know, they're, as you say, taking credit for our work. They're also suggesting, despite the facts, because they're inconvenient for their political narrative, that California is the bad guys, that elected officials are in on the fraud. And it's just outrageous. We recently just did the biggest hospice fraud takedown in the history of California. My office did it, soup to nuts. We did the investigation. We did the arrests. We're doing the prosecution. We have the whole case from beginning to end, and it's the biggest ever in the state of California. So their politicization of this space is very unfortunate, and good care is getting stopped.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's the inherent cruelty of what they're doing to California's healthcare industry. You look, we're not talking about, you know, shoe repair shops that they're accusing of fraud. We're talking about hospice centers, which, as you point out, are end-of-life care. And you look at that in combination with $1.3 billion in Medicaid funding that they froze for California. Mm-hmm. There's one part of it that's like obvious partisan targeting, but then there's just an inherent cruelty when you're talking about the health and welfare of innocent citizens who are just caught in this crossfire. What do you hear from the businesses? Are they freaking out? Are people freaking? I mean, this just seems like this nebulous threat that could come down and have profound consequences on the people that seek services, but and also these businesses that are trying to do. Some of these are smaller hospices that don't have the same access to lawyers as big hospice. You know, these are just independent operators who, you know, in some cases are doing the right thing and trying to provide like empathy in a really critical time.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, some of them are small. They provide hands-on care, you know, person to person, you know, I'll say love and compassion, mm-hmm. Sympathy, care at the end of life, try to make it as painless as possible. And that's a beautiful and important thing to provide. And they are the victims, and they shouldn't be. And it's because of the hard-charging, clumsy, overly aggressive approach fueled by politicization of the Trump administration. And look, fraud is... it exists.
Yeah.
And whenever there is large amounts of money flowing as it flows in Medicaid and in Medicare, there will be bad actors who try to get access to ill-gotten gains and profit from it. They are the perpetrators. The states and the public taxpayers are the victims. And we need to protect ourselves from the perpetrators. The bad guys are the criminals who are trying to take the money, not the government that's providing the support and the infrastructure, definitely not the good actors who are providing the care. And so they have, instead of focusing on the perpetrators, they're getting the good guys, the care providers that are providing end-of-life care for those who need it. And so, you know, we do need to protect and harden our systems from the ability mm-hmm. to be defrauded. And so there's a moratorium that we have in California for any new licenses on hospice fraud. We've so far removed licenses, delicensed, the state of California has, from 350 targeted hospice care providers that were not meeting the requirements and meeting the standards. That was specific, that was individualized, that was targeted in an appropriate way. And those are the right things to be doing. But this overly broad effort to just say, you're all fraudulent and maybe we'll listen to you if you want to come forward and suggest that you're not, you know, this guilty until proven innocent approach is cruel and bad for healthcare and bad for human dignity.
Yeah, that's the essence of it, right? I think that shouldn't be lost in all of this. This is really truly about human dignity, and the cruelty inherent in stealing that dignity from people as they're dying is beyond, I think, a partisan machination. Let me ask you, because first of all, you're in this fight against the Trump administration, and you're in multiple fights, I should say, multiple lawsuits against this administration. You're one of the leading sort of plaintiffs, if you will. Have you interfaced with the vice president on this task force at all?
I haven't personally interfaced with him. We've watched their conduct and their actions, including Dr. Oz, you know, doing a drive-by in California for some direct-to-camera videos and, you know, trying to allege that California government and officials are in on the fraud and then leaving. You know, we're here before the drive-by, after the drive-by, during the drive-by, doing real work, digging into the fraud investigations, arrests, takedowns. The vice president a couple of weeks ago did have a convening, invited state attorneys general. We understand that he invited Republican state attorneys general with quite a bit of notice, maybe a week or 2 weeks or even more. They invited Democratic AGs with one business day before the meeting. And we sent the head of our Medicaid fraud control unit, and she was turned away.
Wow.
Wasn't allowed to participate in the meeting. So it was just gamesmanship. It was performative. It was theater. They didn't really want a conversation. They didn't really want engagement. They wanted to suggest that they invited us when it was really a hollow invitation. And then when we surprised them and accepted their invitation to engage, they turned our lead staff person away at the door. So that speaks volumes to us. That's what engagement with them looks like. It's all political. It's all theater. They don't want real good faith engagement.
I mean, we talk about this, talking about partisanship and political theater. The week that the governor of the state has announced that the feds, the Department of Justice, is looking into the actions of him and his wife. First of all, I mean, you know that California is enemy number one on this administration's list. What was your reaction to that announcement?
Sadness in part that it's gotten deteriorated to this level, but also while shocking, not surprising, this is what this administration does. They've done it time and time again. They've turned the United States Department of Justice into a political weapon where they go after political enemies. They're engaged, instead of engaged in good faith, objective criminal prosecutions where you apply the law and apply the facts. They are involved in political persecutions of their enemies, whether it be New York Attorney General Tish James or James Comey. Now it's Governor Newsom. It is only because they are his enemies that he has sicked the attack dog of the U.S. DOJ on them when there is no evidence of any crime. He's telling them to try to find crimes or manufacture crimes because they're his political enemies. And that's not how blind justice is supposed to work. You're supposed to just follow the facts in good faith to where they lead. If there's a violation of the criminal law, then you objectively apply the criminal law to those facts, but that's not what he's doing. And, you know, I was disheartened, but not surprised to see what he's doing to Governor Newsom and the first partner. And it was wrong with Tish James and Comey and others. It's wrong with Governor Newsom, but it is who he is. He is corrupt, and the president is corrupt, and he is on a vengeance tour going after his political enemies.
You mentioned Tish James, New York AG. The California Department of Justice has launched, I think, is it 68 lawsuits against the Trump administration? Is that right? Is that number the right one?
71 now. Sorry, it goes up in real time. So 68 was absolutely accurate recently, but
Wednesday. But it's Wednesday. Yeah,
exactly.
That was the number on Monday. Do you worry that makes you a target?
I don't, but I don't worry, but it probably does make me a target. You know, we have 71 lawsuits in almost 71 weeks, so it's about once a week. Our position is if Trump violates the law and hurts our states, we'll sue him. If he doesn't violate the law, we won't sue him. It's pretty basic. We think it's completely unremarkable to take the position, and not a lot to ask, that the president of the United States follow the law and comply with the Constitution. And if he doesn't, we'll hold him accountable, hold his feet to the fire. So California was always a target from, you know, before Trump was elected to after he was elected and before he was inaugurated to after he was inaugurated to today. He's going to go after us. And he has. He's tried to take $200 billion from us. We've protected that money with our lawsuits. He's tried to strip birthright citizenship and voting rights away from our people. He tried to unlawfully deploy the National Guard in our state, and we were able to push them out through our lawsuits. He imposed unlawful tariffs that raised the prices for Californians and Americans. We had those struck down as unlawful. We defended our Prop 50 lawful partisan redistricting clapback to Trump's efforts to create 5 new seats in Texas. We defended that at the U.S. Supreme Court. So we are not just suing, we're winning. And we're winning regularly, 80% of the time. And if that makes me a target, so be it. But the people of my state deserve an AG who's fighting for them, who is holding this unlawful president, who is so blatantly and brazenly, consistently and frequently unlawful, accountable. And we will continue. We got a full tank of gas and a ton of energy, and we're going to keep doing it.
I feel like you should really just say your electric battery is charged since you're in California. Tank of gas, come on now.
It's at 100%, my electric battery.
You just had a primary this month. It takes a long time to count ballots in the state of California. We do not have to litigate that here, but Republicans have taken advantage of that window to claim fraud. Spencer Pratt, Donald Trump, others in the administration. You kind of could have seen this one coming a mile away, because the Republican candidate in the days after went from being a viable runner-up to not being in the general in November. And that has raised Republican hackles. And what do they do when they're upset about the outcome of an election? Often they cry election fraud.
Yep.
How are you guys, given the realities of like the way elections work in California and the inevitability of these cries of fraud, how are you preparing for November and I would say 2028?
Yeah, you know, first I'll say there's counting ballots is not fraud. We do have a desire for immediate gratification. And, you know, I think everybody wants full, comprehensive, accurate, reliable voting information and election results as soon as possible. But it's important to do it right. And we have vote-by-mail ballots that come in late that are eligible to be counted. We have provisional ballots that need to be authenticated. We need to authenticate signatures and make sure that they match. So this is all important work. We have 58 registrars of voters throughout the state of California. We're the largest state in the nation with 40 million people, nearly 40 million people. So we're counting ballots. And just because it takes some time doesn't mean it's fraud. Just because you don't get the outcome you want doesn't mean it's fraud. LA is a deep blue city in a deep blue state. There was never a possibility that Spencer Pratt was going to make the top two. It's completely unremarkable that he hasn't. It's exactly what you'd expect. The same is true of Trump losing 3 times, getting thrashed 3 times in the presidential election in California. Steve Hilton, the Republican nominee, will get thrashed. by the Democratic nominee, Javier Becerra. And that's, we are a deep blue state. We reject this MAGA approach and Trumpism. So not a surprise there, but they're crying foul. They're saying that they're cheated. You know, they have this red mirage. They think they're always on the precipice of turning deep blue California red. And, you know, love them for their optimism and hope, but it's just not based in reality. We are very worried about interference from the Trump administration. I have said time and time again that if Trump wants free and fair elections that are reliable and accurate, the best thing he can do is nothing. Do not interfere. Do not create harm. Do not do what you did in Fulton County when you seized ballots. Do not engage in these unlawful executive orders that seek to add new proof of citizenship requirements, or don't count certain vote-by-mail ballots, or try to create a citizenship list so that you can filter out certain ballots from the mail based on a list that the president has. Don't deploy the military or the Marines or ICE at or near polling stations. That's against federal law. We think he might do all those things.
Wow.
And so we've been tabletopping and engaged in exercises, what our responses are, how we go to court, how we get immediate court orders to disperse military from polling stations, to make sure that ballots are preserved and not taken away from the registrar of voters and not seized and tampered with. So we have to be prepared. We owe our people readiness, preparedness. This is more and more the most the biggest issue that my constituents raise with me in my office, concern about the elections being free of interference from Donald Trump.
Wow. Well, here's where we're at. I got to say, though, your track record should give people confidence. 80% success rate. Californians must be tired of all that winning.
California, so much winning. It's exhausting.
Exactly. You can reclaim that along with the term a witch hunt. California Attorney General Rob Bonta, it's really great to have you on Runaway Country. Thanks for joining me and giving us a shot of hope as far as the road ahead.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me, Alex.
After the break, we will put all of this into context with Majority Report host Sam Cedar. Runaway Country is brought to you by ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. I'd love to tell you, I am one of those women who can have 3 glasses of wine and still wake up glowing and ready for Pilates class, but I ain't. Somewhere in my late 20s, let's call it my early 30s, the morning after a few drinks started to hit different. And that's why I started drinking ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It is a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you will feel your best tomorrow. I will say every time I'm smart enough to bring my ZBiotics with me, I notice a difference the next day. Even if I go out, I can confidently plan on being a lucid mother, a lucid coworker, and a semi-lucid podcaster. Between weddings, wine nights, and the first real summer vacation of the year, June barely leaves a Saturday open. Don't I know it? Don't let a rough morning after cost you Sunday. Drink pre-alcohol to stay ahead of it and make the most of every weekend this month. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/Alex and use the code Alex at checkout for 15% off. Runaway Country is brought to you by bookshop.org. Would you be surprised to learn that we're living in a resurgence of independent bookstores? More than 1,000 new stores have opened in the last 5 years. As you know, independent bookstores do more than just sell books. They take care of and pour back into their communities. They create safe spaces that foster culture and curiosity and a love of reading. When you purchase from bookshop.org, you are supporting more than 3,000 local independent bookstores so they can continue their essential work. I literally just ordered a book called Au Pair. It's supposed to be a great summer read. It sounds scary. I might be terrified. I don't know. But I just ordered it from bookshop.org and I'm very excited to start cracking at my summer beach read list, which is mostly scary books and books about unlikely romance. Use code Alex to get 10% off your next order at bookshop.org. That is 10% off at bookshop.org with code Alex. Sam Cedar, what a pleasure it is to have you on Runaway Country in your very professional looking environs. Thank you for joining me to talk about our psychotic vice president.
No, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
So it's Vance week, which, much like Infrastructure Week, hasn't been that, in my humble opinion, hasn't been that successful. I'll get your opinion. He is out on—
But it did happen, which is different from Infrastructure
Week. That is actually true. Although, wasn't Infrastructure Week, like, much like time is a dimension, Infrastructure Week was a dimension where it's constantly happening?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
The Biden years. Okay, so my question to you is this. He's out on spinning the deal. The vice president is spinning the president's deal, which of course no one has seen, the page and a half memorandum of understanding, and is on the airwaves talking about why nobody has seen the deal. This is the vice president of the United States of America on CBS Mornings responding to Norah O'Donnell asking why the text of this deal has not been made public yet.
Yeah, so there are some, frankly, diplomatic protocols that I don't fully understand. The Qataris and the Pakistanis, who have been helpful in mediating this agreement with the Iranians, they've asked us not to release the full text for a little while.
It's the reason, Sam, that nobody's seen this MOU is because of the Pakistanis and the Qataris. That's why. Because you know how deferential this administration is to what the Gulf states wants.
It's diplomatic things amongst very exotic countries that he can't possibly decipher. Who knows what these, the Pakistan, like, look at the
where
way
even
they dress.
Is that country? I mean, where even is
how
that country?
Possibly, I mean, the irony is, I think as he was saying this, the MOU was being leaked at that moment. And, you know, it's interesting. They are at once terrified of, I mean, the bottom line is the war is lost. We lost the war on their terms, on people who wanted to wage this war. We lost it. And there is a sort of a dual set of conflicting terrors, I think, that the administration has. One is they can't get stuck in this. And I think like the timing of this with the Fed meeting, it's a signal to Warsh saying, you don't have to signal that we're going to raise rates because we're going to bring inflation down because energy costs are going to come down. And I think the other sort of terror they have is that people are going to realize they lost the war.
Yeah.
And that these terms, I mean, frankly, from my perspective, these are type of terms that that we should have accepted 20 some odd years ago when the Iranians essentially went through the Swiss and said to George W. Bush in the wake of 9/11, we'll help you. We'll help you find bin Laden. We'll do all of these things, provide a sanction relief, and we will enter the world community. And the Bush administration, full of neocons and desperate to hold on to their axis of evil, ended up sanctioning the Swiss for bringing them that deal. So from my perspective, this is actually, I think, not a bad deal from the perspective of people who don't want to be continually waging war against Iran in some fashion or another. But from the perspective of all the people who wanted to go to war, it is a nightmare.
Well, and this perspective of the 152 children who were killed and the 7,000 civilians who've been killed and the people all over Asia who've not been able to go to work 5 days a week because there's not enough energy. I mean, the chaos that this president unthinkingly spun the globe into for results that could have been had decades ago is just, but to the J.D. Vance of it all. The other part of this, in addition to just like throwing, I don't know, the Pakistanis who've been negotiating all of this with the administration, because they haven't been talking to Mujtaba Khamenei for sure. He says, the reason you're seeing gas prices go down is because the Strait's opening back up. And it's like, hey, no, you're seeing the markets respond and the companies respond. But be aware, dude, that the Strait isn't going to be operating at full capacity for months.
Yeah.
That to me, I think I know how you're going to answer this, but the ability to just manipulate the truth and to just be so
He's just a liar.
It's unbelievable. He's quite talented at it because he has a kind of, he doesn't have a kind of populist bent. I mean, it still comes across as quite slick, but he clearly has no compunction about lying through his teeth to the American public.
No, there is absolutely. That's funny that you say that because when I was thinking about coming on, talking about like his capacity to lie without any sort of like hesitation or, he doesn't get, he doesn't get thrown off by tough questions. Because he has the capacity, he is so shameless, he will lie right through it. It is fascinating. We were told the Strait of Hormuz was already open 2 weeks ago.
Right.
B, we were also told that they had they were only like a week away from developing a nuclear weapon. Now both those things are not true. There's a new narrative for all of this. The world has already, at least at a minimum, a billion point five less barrels of oil that have been circulated in the world. Now, I just read an interesting piece suggesting that China more or less saved the world economy by both manipulating their need for oil and releasing some of their stockpiles, which I think sounds right to me. But this whole thing has been a complete just waste of resources, of like a moral abomination. You mentioned the killing of, well, we've killed thousands of Iranian civilians. There are millions perhaps who are going to suffer from the vaporized oil essentially that spread through Tehran or in the air in Tehran in the early bombing campaigns. And so we'll see. I mean, who knows if this is even going to end up happening on Friday?
Well, that's always, we should timestamp this. We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. Anything's possible. I mean, I think it's highly possible that they never even come to an agreement on uranium enrichment, that this is just, all of this is just a Band-Aid to get the president to have gas below $4 a gallon, but definitely
a
not.
Of a wound that he created.
A gaping wound that remains bleeding. That's such a gross, I'm sorry that I have to say that in the context of Trump. No concealer can cover this up, Sam. No,
exactly.
Vance, you make such a great point, which is there are no tough questions for J.D. Vance when you will lie about anything and everything. And I think you saw that on display also this week when he's answering broader questions about the Trump agenda and its concern about American financial pain. Here he is on The View talking about the president's comments on inflation.
And we've done some things and made some good progress on that point.
He just said he loves the inflation.
What he said, Anna, what he said is that he loves the fact that the inflation is going to come down when this war is over. That's what he said.
That's not what he said.
That wasn't a direct.
Are you his interpreter or are you his vice president? Come on.
It's the laugh at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Me. It's the laugh at the end. What did you make of that, Sam?
Well, I mean, it's on video. We all saw Trump say, I love the inflation. Now, he's...
But he meant he hates the inflation, Sam.
But deep down, he hates it. One, you could argue that just Trump is just not capable of articulating what he means at various times because he is slowly sort of degrading, his mental capacity is degrading. I actually think what that was, and he said the same thing, he said a similar thing about the midterms. Like, I don't care about the midterms. I think Trump was trying to signal to the Iranians, I'm not fazed by this inflation at all. In fact, I love it. And the irony is, I don't know if you saw the reporting by Jeremy Scahill at DropSite, the Iranians had brought in like their top psychiatrists in the country to figure out how they should deal with Trump. And Trump's out there literally functioning like, I have a 13-year-old who is more sophisticated in their negotiations than Donald Trump is. Like, I mean, the idea that the Iranians are like, oh, well, Trump said he loves inflation, so he must not be concerned about any of the stuff. And I think that's what happened. And I think, Vance, he just knows, like, look, I'm in front of a somewhat hostile audience. Nobody's going to check. These guys are not prepared to play the video of Trump. And so he just lies. He lies in over and over again and then just chuckles his, I mean, he does this really well and very often. I still think he's an incredibly unappealing person.
Yeah.
But his capacity to lie really, I think in many ways, unmatched. He just does not get flustered when he has to just tell a very basic lie.
More from Sam Seder right after the break. Runaway Country is brought to you by Miracle Made. Do you ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable? The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That is why I switched to Miracle Made sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology, and they use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Made sheets stay cleaner and fresher up to 3 times longer than regular sheets. That means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and way less laundry. Plus, they feel just as good, if not better, than sheets you'd find at a 5-star hotel, but without that steep price tag. Smooth, breathable, ridiculously comfortable. Upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/Alex and try Miracle Made sheets today. You will save over 40%. And when you use promo code Alex, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift. And with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there is no risk. That's trymiracle.com/Alex, code Alex at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Runaway Country is brought to you by Honeylove. I'm a bra snob. I like them to be comfortable, but they also have to look it. And when I tried my first Honeylove bra, I was sold. They are legit comfortable, especially if you like to work out and you hate sports bras. You want the lifting and the shaping and the support, but you don't want it digging in and making weird back bulges or padding that looks like January Jones and Mad Men. And that is exactly where Honeylove stands out. Their bras are designed to provide that lift and structure using innovative bonding technology instead of uncomfortable underwire. So you get that secure, lifted feel without the poking, pinching, or adjusting. The new crossover contour bra, that I believe is the one I'm trying. It's the best-selling wireless design with molded foam cups to create a smooth, natural shape, or you can take those cups out. And it's especially helpful for mature breasts. I just said it, mature breasts that may want a little extra structure and support. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/Alex. That is honeylove.com/Alex. After you check out, they will ask where you heard about them. Please support Runaway Country and tell them Alex sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. What surprises me is like, okay, on some level, it's like you're the vice president for an increasingly mentally unfit president, right? So you're going to have to do some obfuscation. You're going to have to paper over some of this stuff in the broader, in, I'm giving him the longest runway possible here, right? You're going to have to make this okay in some ways, right? So lies are built into your posture as the vice president of the United States in a moment like this, where the president is saying, unfucking believably, I don't care about Americans' financial situations. I love the inflation, which, by the way, I'm convinced he genuinely thinks. He like, actually, it wasn't some war. I mean, maybe it was wargaming with the Iranians, but I do think the only thing he cares about is his reputation. Like, he doesn't particularly care about the pain of the American voter or the American citizen or American resident. He just wants to make sure it doesn't redound to his disadvantage. Setting that aside and setting aside the sort of excuse I will give J.D. Vance for lying to the public, he will lie even on matters that are deeply ethical ones. And I think the best example of that is his relationship with the Catholic Church, where he is so diametrically, the values of this administration, the values of J.D. Vance are so clearly at odds with those of Pope Leo as head of the Catholic Church. And J.D. Vance, the reason he's doing all this press, Sam, is because he has a book coming out, right? The sequel to Hillbilly Elegy, which is called Communion, Finding My Way Back to Faith, which is all about his path to Catholicism. Nora O'Donnell asked J.D. Vance about his relationship to the church, given the statements from the church and the statements from the vice president suggesting that the Pope doesn't know theology. This is what J.D. Vance had to say this morning.
It has been a little bit more than a year since the election of Pope Leo, yes, our first American pope. He's been highly critical of your administration. What have you learned from Pope Leo?
Well, I think that Pope Leo is trying to balance a lot of competing factors. And, for example, you say he's been critical of the administration, and he has been. He's also said, for example, that a nation is allowed to have secure borders. He said that newcomers to a nation have a duty to integrate. He's also encouraged the administration to treat migrants humanely. And I think that what Pope Leo is trying to do is encourage all of us, whether we're Republicans or Democrats, to strike the right balance between law enforcement and being charitable to others. We're trying to do that in the Trump administration. Sometimes we're not always going to agree with Pope Leo's criticisms, but what I take from the Pope as a Christian and as a Catholic is he's a very important moral voice. His goal fundamentally is to preach the gospel. And even if I don't agree with him, I try to listen, I try to understand, and I try to learn something from it.
I mean, I call bullshit. Let's just say 50 people have died in detention since the Trump administration started their dragnets. We all know about the murders of Alex Pretty and Renee Nicole Good. There are thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of children whose families have been broken apart by these immigration dragnets. There are thousands of children in detention. There are parents whose children have been stolen from them. And there are people living in subhuman conditions in these detention centers. We interviewed the lawyer for one of them on Runaway Country a few weeks ago. And yet J.D. Vance is out there saying, even though he doesn't always agree with the Pope, he listens to him, Sam.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think even frankly, my sense is, based on what little I know about J.D. Vance's Catholicism, is that his brand of Catholicism is does not comport with that of the Pope's. And despite the fact that he was a rather, like a latecomer to Catholicism, I don't know for sure, but I've talked to some writers who suspect that he's somewhere around like Opus Dei, and there's a big honestly, there's a big Opus Dei contingency in this country.
There is,
and they tend to be in positions of power, and there's not many. We're talking like literally a handful of thousands in the five figures, Opus Dei in the country. But some of them end up being Supreme Court justices. Some of them end up being senators and economic advisors and whatnot. I just don't think he has any type of actual genuine moral compass, and I think his brand of Catholicism is really sort of like intertwined with all of the Peter Thiel notion. Like, not to get too like sort of in the weeds about this, but these are Straussians. These are people who believe that. They are anti-democratic. Peter Thiel has been very explicit about this, that democracy is a problem. He had a problem with the women's right to vote because he felt that it would lead to socialism. He said in the run-up to the 2024 election that we're living in Weimar Germany and people are tired of democracy. I mean, he is going around the country right now on a antichrist tour. I mean, this stuff all sounds nuts, and it is. But and Peter Thiel is relevant to J.D. Vance insofar as that he has essentially created J.D. Vance in a test tube. He provided him his first work out of law school. He provided him tens of millions of dollars to run as a senator in Ohio, and then ended up delivering tens of millions of dollars more to the Trump campaign when he picked J.D. Vance. And so this guy's worldview is, I think, it's influenced by a lot of very, very strange people. And so, it's impossible to reconcile. We now, a new report came out today, 780,000 children kicked off of food assistance. There's no, I'm sorry, to maintain some semblance of a religious piety and be part of an administration that is doing this simply for tax cuts for for millionaires, I don't buy it.
It's antithetical to the message of Christ. I'll say
it,
that much.
It seems like I don't know that much about.
I mean,
the message of Christ,
I'm a Catholic.
But
pretty
from what
lapsed,
I've heard,
but
it is.
It is. I feel confident in saying that. You brought up the Thiel connection, and it's interesting because Vance is trying to sort of craft himself or cast himself as a populist. He's been in his book, he rails against conservative donors. He's kind of, you know, trying to get the backdraft of the Hillbilly Elegy story. But really, he was created in a lab by Peter Thiel. He's the first tech venture capitalist to be in the White House. Do you think, I mean, how much do you think that's the stench of Silicon Valley follows him as he moves forward with greater ambitions to be president? Because we don't talk about it, I think,
enough.
We talk much more about Trump's association. I mean, it's obviously public because he takes them on field trips to China and is constantly seen with his tech courtiers at his knee. But Vance truly is the original bro oligarch. If he didn't make that much money, he's in that bro sphere in a much more authentic way than Trump is.
Oh, totally. In fact, I'm convinced, if you go back and look at the timing of when Elon Musk endorsed Trump, ostensibly it was because of Butler, but it really was, I think, centered around when the reports came out that he was going to pick J.D. Vance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was a big project for all the tech people, David Sachs and the crypto people. And no, I don't think that stench actually sticks on him nearly enough. And I think part of it, frankly, was just like the way the media responded to Hillbilly Elegy. There is a deep, deep defensiveness, I think, in a lot of the media, that because a lot of them are situated on the coast, that we don't really know what's going on in the Midwest and in the flyover countries. And if we have someone who can translate for us, somebody who both went to Yale and then, but also ostensibly is from, the Appalachian stock, then we're going to promote this guy and have really uncritically. And I think that whole idea, the hillbilly elegy, where it didn't, you know, somehow his VC days did not follow him into office in any way. And I think part of that was also like the Democratic Party over the course of the past 15, 20 years, well, really, maybe 40 years, has been so tied in many respects to that money that it's harder to campaign against it.
It's harder to police the bad behavior when you're part of the same circles.
I think the problems that Vance are going to have are more the stench from the Trump administration. When I talk about 2020, because that's what this week is, or the past couple of weeks have been his sort of pre-launch. He's going to start to really run after the midterms, but this is a way to set the table. And what I find really fascinating about this is that he is being given the credit and the critique for this Iran deal. Like Trump today, Wednesday, said, well, if it works out well, I'll take the credit. If it's a bust, I'll give it to JD.
This way, if it works out, I'm going to take the credit. If it doesn't work out, I'm blaming JD. You better be careful, JD. He's going to turn his plane around and get the hell out of here. Yeah, I like that idea. I think it's a good idea.
But, I mean, I track a lot of this conservative media. Ben Shapiro, Kilmeade on Fox and Friends, they were all saying this is J.D. Vance. And I suspect there's, you know, that concept of the humble brag. I think J.D. Vance is out there. This is his way of appealing to the anti-war, to the extent that
there
is
one. Yeah, the American firsters.
The American firsters, and really, in many respects, the sort of the anti-Israel elements of his base. And so he's going to try and get credit for this if it actually happens. And I find that it's interesting. He's decided what lane he's going to run in. And ostensibly probably against Marco Rubio, who has been completely sidelined from this entire...
The Secretary of State.
Yes.
The Secretary of State. I don't know. Little Marco may be onto something. The New York Post is calling this deal a love bomb. You know, J.D. Vance clearly thinks he has room, ground to make up with America Firsters. He was on Megyn Kelly's podcast trying to sort of align himself with her and Tucker's brand of isolationism. Yep. He's trying to woo them. But at the end of the day, I don't know. I think a lot of people are going to be skeptical of this deal once the details are finally released, insofar as there are details. I'm not convinced it's a W. And if you're Marco Rubio, maybe it's a good thing to be the viceroy of Greenland in the end, as opposed to the architect of this surrender to Iran.
He wants to be the prefect of Cuba.
Well, that's probably what he will end up being at some point.
Here's the other thing. I don't think there is a constituency, an anti-war constituency. I don't think he's going to get rewarded, even if he is considered responsible for ending the Iran war, which I imagine he's setting himself up for the option to herald that 6-8 months or in the campaign. I'm the one who actually ended the Iran war. And he's setting the predicate. He's basically like, you know, tilling the ground right now. And I think he'll decide 6 to 8 months from now, do I want to take credit for that?
Right.
And so he set himself up in that way, I think in a fairly good way. And, you know, the same thing with the Epstein files. There was a big piece in the New York Times this week, which was an excerpt from a book from Haberman and Swan, I guess it was.
Regime Change.
And reportedly, they also have audio. And this is from the most secure location, theoretically.
The sit room.
Should really
reassure all of us who are concerned about our national security apparatus.
I mean, and you read that piece, and it's quite clear that Vance or Vanceites
are leaking.
Are the ones who are leaking a lot of that material, and he wants to be seen as the guy who also was like, "I want to get the Epstein files out. I want to." I mean, he's very much aligned with Tucker Carlson. I think in terms of politics, and it's unclear to me how much of a constituency Tucker Carlson has. When it comes to voters, I mean, it might be good if you want to launch a podcast to be able to, I mean, honestly, like, you know, there's a difference between a popular podcaster on the right and how many people you're actually speaking to in the context of the voters. But maybe from a primary perspective, aligning with Tucker Carlson could be fairly powerful. But it's quite clear, like, he is setting up his post-Trump narrative. This is not a situation where, like, he's going to be saying there's no daylight between me and Donald Trump. And also, I got to think, like, there is a decent percentage that J.D. Vance may very well be the incumbent in 2028.
Oh, my God.
Or that in the context of, running for that primary, Trump just won't be in a position to refute the claims that J.D. Vance makes. Like, I was the voice for peace in the administration. I was the Epstein whisperer, and I did my best, but I was the vice president.
You're totally, I completely agree with you that we've seen two kind of seminal pieces from Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan. One is the TikTok on how the U.S. was led to war, and that features J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio prominently as the voices of reason in the sit room. You can only assume that's leaks coming from J.D. Vance's camp to preemptively rebut ideas that he betrayed his ethics of not wanting America to be involved in military adventurism. And then the other one is the background on the Epstein files and how the White House scrambled to contain the fallout, again, with some choice sort of words of wisdom from J.D. Vance. Again, a strategy to distance the vice president from the worst actions of the president while also not publicly having to do so, but laying the foundations for his inevitable, space creation when he runs for president in 2028. I mean, we have talked at length on here about his shamelessness, his opportunism, his, I would say, cowardice in being unable to stand up on any kind of principle. And yet, Sam, I feel like on some issues relating to nationalism and specifically white Christian nationalism, J.D. Vance, like if he has convictions on that stuff, I think they might run deeper than Trump's. Like, I think he is a true believer, ironically, having an Indian wife and multiracial children. But I think he is a true believer in this, in the sort of most toxic forms of blood and soil nationalism. And I think you have to look no further than the speech he gave at the Claremont Institute last summer, last July. And if you haven't listened to it, you should, because I think it's the closest we get to the real inner workings of J.D. Vance and which direction his moral compass points in. Here's a clip.
If you think about it, identifying America just with agreeing with the principles, let's say, of the Declaration of Independence, that's a definition that is way over-inclusive and under-inclusive at the same time. I think the people whose ancestors fought in the Civil War have a hell of a lot more claim over America than the people who say they don't belong. Because America is not just an idea. We're a particular place with a particular people and a particular set of beliefs and way of life.
I mean, I watch that. I mean, it's very hard for me. Like, I'm the child of an immigrant. My mother is Buddhist. My dad was Catholic. I went to Orthodox Jewish nursery school. Like, I'm like the upside down of that vision that J.D. Vance is proposing. But I mean, so is his own family. Like, where does the Hindu religion fit into the particular set of beliefs? Where do Indian ethnic traditions fit into a particular way of life? Like, I know your people are from Kentucky, but what about the other half of your family? What did you think about that? And do you think, am I overstating it when I say I think Vance's core convictions about white nationalism and the supremacy of white Christianity in American life, those convictions run deeper than maybe even Donald Trump's?
Oh, I think without a doubt. And I remember that era where he went to the Claremont Institute. I mean, he was doing that speech, a variant of that speech, for a while at that time. And I think that was like, I think this is a really good indication of who J.D. Vance would be if he sees daylight. Like if he, like, you know, like I think at that time they thought they were ascendant, that there was going to be no slowing this roll of ICE, and Stephen Miller was, feeling his full bravado, and Elon Musk is still in the fold, or at least explicitly. And I think he's getting into real fascistic territory. And I think they got a little cut off at the pass, and, you know, you see a much more reasonable, at least attempting sounding like, you know, when he was on The View, when they
sanitized.
Asked him about immigration, yeah, sanitized, yeah. And having to lie because the facts are the facts. You know, 75% of the people that ICE has rolled up have no criminal records, and if they were going after the worst of the worst, you would imagine we would have heard about one shootout, they travel with like three different cameramen at any given time. If there was any sort of like dangerous situation for ICE guy, we would be fed that 24/7. And yet we don't see that. So I think that was a moment where a lot of like that Peter Thiel stuff, which I do believe he genuinely believes, they were feeling like this is an opportunity for us. I mean, you know, this is a guy who has also praised Curtis Yarvin, who was Munch's monk bagger. I can't remember his blogger handle. But this is a guy who, aside from, you know, constantly taking acid and, reading J.R.R. Tolkien books, has this vision of, and this is where Thiel reportedly got some of his ideas too, that democracy is over. We need to have a king of sorts. The whole idea is that there are people who are the elite, mm-hmm. Will decide for the rest of us. And having a nation that is homogenous is there a strength and is the project? I mean, yeah. And so And I think at that time, he was really happy to get out in front there. And I think now he probably feels like, my peeps know where I stand.
Yeah.
And now I've got to start to sort of like
stand back and stand by. General.
Yeah.
More of my conversation with Sam in just a minute. But first, guys, CrookedCon 2026 is happening November 5th through 7th in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be even bigger than last year. And I am excited to say I will be there. My train ticket is booked. That is a lie. It is not, but it will be soon. There will be more panels across bigger stages, candidate forums, live shows, interviews, organizing events, and tense but cathartic moments between prominent media figures who have yelled at each other on the internet. Friends of the Pod subscribers get an exclusive discount on the all-day event on November 7th, in addition to many other perks we cannot wait to tell you about. There are four events total. Go to crookedcon.com to get your tickets for each and any of them. We can't wait to see you there. Runaway Country is brought to you by Common Power. You know that feeling when you're listening to your favorite political podcast, Runaway Country, and you hear a story that urges you to step up and be part of the solution? That feeling is the essence of Common Power. Whether it is accountability from our political leaders, the impacts of AI on the environment, or the fact that everything is so damn expensive, winning the House and Senate is essential to solving these issues. Since 2018, Common Power has been the organizing force for training and deploying volunteers to door knock for Democrats in over 20 battleground states and over 50 races in this year alone. Their teams are driven by next generation leaders, and we need your support to scale and fund their travel. If you're watching this or listening to this, you are probably well aware of how pivotal the midterm elections are. And no matter what state you're in, this is your opportunity to do more. For those of you who refuse to sit this moment out, you can donate to Common Power at commonpower.org/crooked and help Democrats take back power in Congress.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Okay, if there is one thing, when I look at that speech, I really do get shivers. It makes me very worried. But then I remember what it's like to actually see J.D. Vance on the campaign trail. And I want to close out this part of our conversation.
I know what it is.
You know what it is, right?
Is it at the diner, at the donut shop?
The donut shop.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just play. I mean, it's for one more time, for old time's sake. Just a reminder of Mr. Populist, J.D. Vance, when he comes into contact with an actual person or people, how cringe that situation is. A reminder, a throwback to the campaign in 2024 when J.D. Vance, as a candidate, goes to what is called an OTR. It's an impromptu stop that is planned in advance by the campaign, where it is to showcase the candidate's skills as a normal, average guy in the world. This is what happened with J.D. Vance when he tried to order some donuts.
Yeah, I would get a couple dozen, sir.
A couple dozen?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah. She doesn't want to be on film, guys, so just cut her out of anything. Appreciate that, man. I'm J.D. Vance, American Vice President. Good to see you.
Okay.
How long are you working?
I've been here since the beginning of July.
Okay.
Everything?
Just everything, yeah. I mean, a lot of glazed here, some sprinkle stuff. Somebody sent in rolls.
Okay. I mean, the best is like, I'm J.D. Vance. I'm running for vice president.
Okay.
Okay. And then he can't even get the donut order, Sam.
And then at one point he asks like,
how long this place been around?
Yeah. How long this place, and has no follow-up to it. The answer could have been 15 minutes.
We
just opened up 15 minutes.
100
years.
We've
been here for 50 years. And he's just like, yeah, okay.
Okay.
Anyways, so uncomfortable.
This is what but in your darkest moments, when you worry about this individual maybe taking the reins of our democracy, you just play that clip. It's a reminder that he has no aptitude for politics. He really just doesn't.
I absolutely agree. Like I don't worry about him as a candidate unless he ascends to the presidency before the 2028 election. I mean, you know, it's, you know, if I was an an actuarial, I could tell you exactly what the chances of that are. But I think it's greater than zero.
Okay. Well, we're going to focus on the donut shop, Sam. I'm going to hold out. I'm going to pin my hopes to a glazed donut or whatever.
The sprinkles,
glaze, whatever. And I want to close out by asking you about people who do have aptitude for this, namely you. You have aptitude for political conversation and, shall I say, debate. For people who have missed the Jubilee video you did in March of 2025, yeah, baby, it went mega viral. I think, how many is it? 7.5 million views on my last count. It's called One Progressive versus 20 Trump Supporters. These things are like, give me agita. Like I get like acid reflex watching them, but yours is very good. Let's just play a super cut of you doing yeoman's work in this forum.
In Trump's cabinet, there are people of color that Democrats pretend don't exist, like J.D. Vance's wife. And
J.D. Vance's wife is not in the cabinet.
Raising the man-made raising temperatures by 1 to 2 degrees Celsius in the next 150 years isn't necessarily a detriment to society. Human beings.
You don't think so?
No, human beings are very good at innovation, and we can build seawalls, and we can create carbon
technology.
What
kind of seawall are you going to build for Miami? Are you allowed to fire them if you find out they're trans?
If you need to, then you should.
So we have a disagreement. Right, I don't believe people should be discriminated against.
Like, what's the problem with xenophobic nationalism? Don't you think that's better for Americans in general?
Xenophobic nationalism is better.
We should have a coherent culture. Everyone should be a part of the same culture. We should have assimilation.
Which, do you get to choose what the culture is?
We already have a dominant culture.
What is the dominant culture?
Based on European and Christian values and identity.
I think you're making my argument for me.
I think she's making J.D. Vance's argument for him.
Side note, she became a sort of right-wing talker for a while and then had to drop out of politics when it came out that she had an affair. Mm. She was a trad wife, but
well,
slightly different tradition, I think.
Maybe untrad wife. Yes. You're not allowed to do that in the trad wife world. Do you feel like you, well, first of all, how did that feel? It's my nightmare. And do you feel like I am constantly asked, like, what do we do about the divide that exists? Like, how do you bridge it? Like, how do we get at the things that separate us? And I wonder, like, what those forums make you feel about the sort of reckoning between our two Americas?
I think there's like 35% of the country. There is no bridge to them. I don't think there is a bridge. I think you can, if you reach the 5 or 10% who don't pay attention really to politics that much, I think it comes down to getting those people on board. And then I think there has to be a follow-up with actually like real material, I wouldn't say radical, but maybe in the context of the way that things have worked, radical change in terms of legislation and the structure of our society. And then I think the worst tendencies of people are not expressed by sort of like that margin between 55 and 35 if their material lives are easier.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, I think ultimately that's what it comes down to. I mean, like this country was in many respects built on racism and has never really gotten past the specter of racism. I mean, and now we're back to, you know, like where we were arguably 60 years ago when it comes to voting.
I was going
to
say post-Reconstruction era.
Yes, yes, very much.
I was going to say late 1800s.
I mean, people, you know, Jim Crow and really the you know, 19-teens in 20, when, like, you know, the KKK was at 6% of the country were card-carrying members of the KKK. They were going to, you know, they were involved in this, the 150th celebration of the country's birthday. I mean, this was, and so I think there's a certain percentage of people you just will not reach. And it's not just about race, but that's a big part of it. And, So I don't worry about bridging the divide. I think from a, as a political matter, it is reaching people who are really not that engaged, and then providing enough material benefits when you're in power. I've been doing really two things. One is consolidate power. And when it comes to Democrats, it really ends up being sort of democratize things. Statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico. Voting rights. Maybe
abolish the filibuster.
Abolish the filibuster. Any way you can democratize things, you do so. And Supreme Court reform, for that matter. And then allowing that structure that you have worked on to facilitate providing real material benefits for people and durable ones. Because when people's lives materially improve, when they're not feeling worried about whether their kids are going to have healthcare or food for that matter, or whether they're going to have a decent retirement, the racial prejudices and religious prejudices and just the need to otherize diminishes. It's not going to diminish. There's always going to be, I think, like a portion of our society where that's not going to make a difference. I mean, you know, you have some very wealthy people who went to crash the, you know, Congress on January 6th. You're not going to reach everybody, but I think you can reach a solid majority of people with that material benefit. And as a political matter, I think that's what we need to do, as just simply a moral injustice matter too. But I think that's the way. I don't, you know, bridging the divide. I think if people are materially well off, there'll be more politeness, but I think there'll be a certain portion of people who will still harbor, a parochialism and a resentment that we're not going to get past.
TLDR, give people healthcare, raise wages, and you won't need as many Jubilee videos out there in the world.
Let's hope.
You did a great job, Sam.
Well, thank you.
That and on this. Thank you for joining Runaway Country. It is a real treat to have you here. I hope you come back.
I'm happy to. Thank you, Alex. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Sam. That is our show for this week. Please don't forget to check out the show and our rapid response videos on our YouTube channel, Runaway Country with Alex Wagner. And if you're not sick of me yet, take a look at my Substack, How the Hell with Alex Wagner. Last but not least, if you have been impacted directly by the Trump administration or its policies, send us an email or a one-minute voice note at runawaycountry@crooked.com, and we may be in touch to feature your story. A huge thank you to everyone who has written in already. Runaway Country is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Alona Minkowski, Emma Illich-Frank, Haley Jones, and Anisha Banerjee, with help from Eric Shoot, Kenny Moffitt, and Charlotte Landis. Production support from Ben Hethcote, Katie Long, Adrian Hill, and Matt DeGroat. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.